Hello, everyone. Thank you for watching The Naturalist Capitalist. I am doing a late night stream tonight because I had a long ass day. I worked about 14 hours, drove about 600 miles with an oversized load that did not like going up hills. So I got a pretty special guest today. If I'm wrong and he's right and God does exist, it seems like God does not want him to come on this show because I think this is the third time in a row that we've tried to schedule this thing. And every time something, you know, something obstructs it from happening, but we push through anyway. So I've got Jacob Winograd of the Biblical Anarchy podcast on the show. How are you doing tonight?
Good, man. I really wanted to make a, I'm sorry you had to carry my mom around all day joke when you were talking about a heavy load that didn't want to go up hills. I'm still, still stuck in high school in my mind, I guess, though.
Oh, good. I mean, you follow me on Twitter, you know.
Yeah, I was like, I can make that joke here.
So is it Jacob Winograd or Jacob Daniel? Is that your middle name or what?
So Daniel is my middle name. I didn't have my last name on my profile for the longest time. And then when I named my podcast, it's Daniel 3 Biblical Anarchy. I just kind of stuck with it. And plus, I don't know, I maybe don't want to advertise my last name all over the place, but it is on my profile now. I did that because my wife got involved and I don't know. It was just like her name was Winograd. So I wanted to make obvious that we were married or something. So I don't know. But yeah, it's Winograd is my last name, but I just go by Jacob Daniel more commonly.
Well, sorry if I wasn't supposed to broadcast your name.
Oh no, it's what I'm still figuring it out as I go, if I want to even broadcast it or not. Cause like some people do, and for them it works. I've already had, and I'm not even that big yet. Like I'm smaller than you. And I've already had some nasty people come after me and dox me and shit. So recently I've begun to go back down that rabbit trail of how much do I want to advertise about my identity? I feel like sometimes it's futile in this day and age to even try to hide stuff though. Like it's more of a cost than what you can gain out of it, I think, for sure. A lot of, yeah. And yeah, Rob, someone made a comment like Russian, and yeah, my last name Winograd is literally the Russian word for a grape. So that's why I was on a Blackbird podcast with my friend James Jettiman, and he called me Jacob the Grape. So that is accurate.
So Caleb wants you to put a an intro. I actually did see part of your little pre-broadcast you did before you came on here while I was driving. I caught a little bit of it and I heard you guys talking about an intro. So Caleb wants you to put one in there apparently.
Yeah. Everyone keeps bugging me for an intro. I don't know. It's like, I have like a little like cutesy intro, like a little like musical thing that plays before my podcast on like Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't do it for the live, but I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll make something at some point, but I just, you know, it's on the never ending list of to do things.
Sure. So tell us about your, before we get into your podcast, just tell us about yourself. What's your deal? Where do you live? Where do you come from? What's your background? How did you become a libertarian? How did you become a Christian? Were you raised those ways? Just give us the lowdown.
Okay. I was raised a Christian. I've pretty much been a Christian my whole life. I mean, I didn't have a huge, like some people that are raised Christian have a huge rebellious phase. I mean, I had like a mini one, but not one that caused me to like question my faith. I was just, you know, young and in high school and, you know, my parents didn't want me to date yet. And I did. So that was the, you know, sneaking over to girls' houses and stuff when I was a teenager and stuff. But I've always been Christian. I've always been strongly like convinced of the truth of the Bible and of, you know, the story of Jesus primarily. And, you know, like the kind of cliche thing, like, you know, I profess Jesus as like my Lord and Savior. Like, you know, for me, it's a very personal thing. Like, I feel like my relationship to God and the Bible and through Jesus and like his sacrifice, like it has a personal meaning for me. You know, I'm not very religious in the sense of like I go to church, but it's not very like, liturgical church. And I'm not very big on like all the, you know, like I curse, I make, you know, I have like a kind of dark, twisted sense of humor. I don't know, like, I don't believe in acting religious in like the, like, you know, kind of dogmatic kind of way. And I think that's actually more biblical than what people realize. I feel like, you know, if you look back, there's some cool, like when Jesus turned water into wine, and there's other things in the Bible where it's just like, you know, the stories that I think show kind of like what the true nature of being a Christian should be. And it's not supposed to be like, you know, no fun and just you're constantly worried about, like, I don't know, like not offending people all the time. But I was raised in a conservative household, as far as like my political views, and coming out of high school, I was like I was on a college track for a while, then decided not to be. And I ended up working at my dad's auto shop. I rebuild transmissions for a living now. But because I was like in, like, I was taking like AP history and all this, and I was taught a very revisionist, like, and very intentionally taught like the revisionist history of like American politics and economics and stuff. So I kind of became a bit of a leftist post high school, even though I had the conservative Christian upbringing. So I was like a progressive Christian. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter back in like 2015, 2016. Oh, wow. I might get canceled on this show for saying this, but I actually voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Voted for Romney in 2012, and I voted for John Kasich in the primary in New Hampshire in 2016. So
I feel like Hillary's worse, but I don't know. They're all pretty bad. I kind of, you know, was on the left, although because I had my Christian roots, like there were some things that made me even a zebra among horses on the left. Like I didn't always quite fit in there perfectly, but I was still kind of, you know, very economically left, even socially left a bit. Like I was a bit of an SJW, you know, go around calling people racists and bigots and all that for their views and stuff. But then like Trump kind of shattered everything for me because like there was all the fear mongering around him, and like, he's a racist, homophobe, transphobe, he's gonna start all these wars and stuff, and not to say Trump was great, but like a year in I realized like, okay, so that was a lot of fear mongering and it wasn't really that accurate. And you know, I was starting to talk more with conservatives and stuff, and I watched a debate between Ben Shapiro and Cenk Uygur, which, as much as Ben Shapiro sucks on a lot of other things, he's good on economics, and that shattered my view of Keynesian economics and kind of like social democracy and all that, because he basically debunked the idea that universal healthcare works. And I was a big, like, because I was into Bernie Sanders, I was like universal healthcare, free education, like those were the things I pushed. And then when I started to actually learn about economics, that was sort of like my intro into libertarianism. And from Shapiro I got into Dave Rubin, from Rubin I got into Rogan I met Dave Smith then was the, you know, intro to everything else. I found local libertarians in my area. I got involved in the Mises Caucus. I very rapidly, over like a 2-year period, went from Bernie bro to anarcho-capitalist. That's how I kind of ended up where I'm at now. And then I started my podcast and page because I then, like, the final step in the journey was I tried to connect my political beliefs to my religious ones, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Yeah, so I was raised you know, very conservatively and very Christian, and it was when I left high school, I started working and I started expanding my horizons. I realized that conservatism, at least like neoconservatism and this new weird you know, form of conservatism that's overtaken the country, it really didn't align with Christian values at all. No. Because in my mind, Jesus was an anarchist. I've thought this for a long time. I do want to get into whether or not he was a libertarian, but I did think he was an anarchist. I did think he was someone who did not advocate for government force, or didn't even really necessarily care about the government. It seemed to me when I was a Christian that Jesus really cared about the condition of your soul. And that was pretty much all that mattered, like your soul and other people's souls. And so this whole injection of Jesus into this like right-wing evangelical culture, especially when it got into things like Zionism and then into state mandates of morality, I was really disconnected from that from an early political age. You know, once I actually got out of the house and started thinking on my own and really diving into these things. Did you ever have that sudden disconnect, or was that just...
Well, that was part of why I fell into the left too, was seeing how awful the neoconservatives were and how awful evangelical circles were. And they didn't reflect Christ very well. And as much as I have issue today with like progressive Christianity, there is an element there that they got right, I think. Sure. Like they rejected the neoconservatism, but like then like went hardcore embracing the statism and the socialism, which I hate. But there's their version of Jesus in a lot of ways is a bit closer to mine in terms of like, I don't know, like not being this weird authoritarian, I guess, in this like control freak that they make Jesus out to be. And kind of like what you said, like, you know, as far as like the one thing the left is still good on to this day, even as much as I don't like the modern left, they aren't as like cucked for American exceptionalism.
Sure.
And like, you know, worshiping the flag, worshiping American imagery and stuff like that. And that was like very prominent on the right and turned, and it's always turned me off. So I've always had libertarian leanings, I guess, in my personality. So that was part of what drew me to the left too. It wasn't just the economics, but like it was, those were the first Christians I found that weren't like just super, you know, like worshipy of the state. And, you know, Jesus always talks about my kingdom is not of this world. I think that the primary reason that the Jews rejected Jesus as Messiah, and even today reject him as Messiah, is because he like rejected politics. And to the Jews, the Messiah was more of a political figure and supposed to bring about more of a political salvation, more so than a spiritual one. So, right. Yeah, I think your intuitions were accurate.
Yeah, I mean, progressives, as you know, as screwed up as their economics are, or their state mandate of economics, I do feel like in general, like a truly good progressive only wants the state to be there to help the people who need help, you know, like, I mean, because there is like a lot of there's a big mess with like these progressives who say they're great on these things and then they're not, like the Young Turks, people like that. But
yeah,
really sincere progressives who you know, just want a safety net. I feel like when it comes to everyday life, they don't really want to control you. You know, they care about the people who are trodden upon, and then they want to live their own lives. The problem is like liberals and leftists and progressives have all become this mesh of one identity to everybody who's not on the left. Where I've interviewed a lot of great like far leftists on the show who are against vaccine mandates. They're against, you know, they're against gun control. They're against like all these social controls that a lot of left-leaning people want. They're just, you know, they still want the strong safety net. But that in general seemed more akin to free will. You know, the idea that, you know, you make your own decisions, which is very Christian, you know, the idea that it's up to you, you know, your salvation and whether or not you feel sorry about the things you've done. Where conservatism was much more authoritarian, it was sort of Old Testament like, you know, instead of the New Covenant, I guess.
Yeah, very, very theocratic in nature, and focusing too much on condemning people and sort of like almost like this. It's like they have it backwards. They're like, you have to clean your act up before you come to Christ, which is like the opposite of what the Bible teaches, which is like, no, like you actually can't clean your mess up before you come to Christ. That's why Jesus did what he did, was because like, he needed to be that advocate for you to save you. And the, you know, like you get born again, and it's not like a instant thing. There's a process of sanctification and growing closer and becoming more Christ-like over time. And the renewing of your mind. Like one of my favorite Christian podcasts is by R.C. Sproul. It was called the Renewing Your Mind podcast, because it's the idea that like, it's a never ending journey of just trying to, you know, let go more of the earthly sinful side of you and grow closer to Christ. But it's only through Christ and through what he did that that's possible. And too much of right-wing evangelical churches are like the opposite. It's like we want our hospital to be filled only with healthy people. Like it's just it's they have it completely backwards. And even today, it's, you know, like I'm kind of homeless when it comes to a church. Like I have a church I attend kind of frequently, but and I want to find a church to like plug my family into, but there's just, you know, the progressive churches are too statist. The conservative churches are sometimes less statist, but more, they're still authoritarian in their orientation, which I find to be problematic.
Yeah, what do you think of the right-wing Christian embrace of Trump? Because obviously he's not really, I wouldn't call Trump a neocon quite. I mean, he definitely had some of those tendencies, but he was a different breed. He was something new. But it was really ironic to me how how quickly and how easily the Christian right accepted him. Did that drive you nuts at all, or what did you think about
Oh yeah. Well, like, you know, it drove me nuts at first because I was a leftist when he was big. And to me, it was like cementing. I was like, wow, like Trump is bringing out literally the worst things of the right wing Christian circles that like made me not like them. Mm-hmm. And even now, like as I've, you know, become a libertarian, I still see now it's like my problem with Trump is less the like basically lies that were told about him, or at least like the fear mongering and stuff and the propaganda about him that I was told when I was a leftist. Now it's more just like I see conservatives who kind of like they treat Trump like he's the latest golden calf. You know what I mean? Like it's very much a personality cult, and it's the whole like 3D trust. Trump is still my president and all this stuff. And it's like Trump is Jesus to them. Like he's the new savior. And, you know, I mean, a mantra of Christian anarchism is no king but Christ. And I don't know, like, to me, that crystallizes it so perfectly in those four words. It's like, if you're looking to anything in this world as your savior, if you're putting your hope in anything other than Christ, you're probably not doing Christianity right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Christianity, you know, when I really internalized it was probably... I don't know how old I was. I was probably a teenager, and I always had some issues with it. And there's some stuff that I don't know if I really ever believed about it. But when it was the realest to me that it ever was, it was sort of like a universalist Christianity that I believed in. I didn't, you know, necessarily believe that all the events in the Bible were historical. I thought a lot of them were metaphorical. I eventually got to a place where I didn't really believe that hell was a thing anymore. And so it basically just got so vague that I had to kind of reset and say, okay, what do I actually believe here? Am I just believing this stuff because it's what I'm so used to? Or is this really sincere? Do I actually believe in any of this? But when I was still in that point of accepting Christianity and, you know, I believed in it the most that I ever did, I really think I was pretty in line with what you think about, you know, the state and Christianity. That was always, and I already mentioned this a little bit, but that was always really repulsive to me when they would try to mix Christianity with government. And I always thought it was pretty biblical that, at least in the New Testament, not so much the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, you know, Jesus was really against the church. He really hated the Pharisees. He hated the merger of business and church and state and church. And even some of the Old Testament, you know, like when Samuel was talking to the Israelites and they said, we want a king. And he said, no, you don't. You know, if you have a king, he's going to take this much of your crop. He's going to enlist your sons. You know, you don't want this. You want God. And they were like, no, give us a king. Give us a king. And then he finally gave them a king, and it was Saul, and it was terrible, and it was a disaster. So I always kind of, I think for the most part, when I was a Christian and it was real to me, I pretty much agreed with you. But why don't you give us your basic philosophy on why Christianity can bring people to anarchy, why they go hand in hand, and why they're not opposites?
Yeah, sure. The way I like to like split it into two categories, there's two types of relationships that the Bible talks about. And there's the vertical relationship between God and man, and that's the one that people often think is in conflict with anarchism. I don't think it is, and I'll get into that as I go. Then there's the horizontal relationships, and these are the ones where it's the most obvious, I think, that Christianity is not just in good keeping, or it's compatible with anarchism. I think it actually preaches anarchism. And that's the sense that no man has the right to own another man. Like, to me, it's, you know, like, I'm an anarcho-capitalist, I'm a, you know, Austrian, and I believe in the idea of self-ownership and property rights. And I think that the teachings of the Bible regarding property regarding our relationships to our brothers and sisters, to our neighbors, even to our enemies, are pretty clear in that we don't have the right to be the master or the owner of other people, or to initiate force against them or violate their rights. And, you know, it's pretty consistent. You know, some of the confusions can be around like the scriptures regarding authority. And I think that the easiest way to dispel that is to remind people what Jesus talked about when he talked about being a leader. Jesus equated being a leader to being a servant. And it's not in the like cliche, cringy way where politicians call themselves public servants, but in the actual biblical way of being a servant. And I think this was great. The greatest example of this was Jesus himself, not just like his entire life and sacrifice as, you know, like the ministry he had, but also in the story where he washed his apostles' feet as a demonstration. He was like, basically like to be a leader, to be someone who is considered a good leader and faithful to God is to be a servant to those around you. And this is repeated throughout the New Testament, and really a lot of the New Testament is echoing the Old Testament. So you can find it there as well. You know, there's like a passage in John where he says, if anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will be my servant also. Galatians talks about like we're called to freedom, but we use our freedom not as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love to serve one another. Mark 10:42, Jesus warns his apostles. He says the Gentiles, you know, they're obsessed with these kingdoms of men, and they're always trying to rule over one another. He actually uses the word, the Greek version of archist. It's like archonist or something like that. And he's like, the Gentiles are always trying to be archists over one another. It will not be that way among you. And it's like, you know, the very strong teaching in the New Testament about how like we're all equal in Christ, that none of us are different in Christ. And so, yeah, I think self-ownership and the idea that no one owns anyone else is the consistent teaching of specifically Jesus. And then, you know, I think that's consistent the whole way through the Bible, property rights and all that. And when you start to, like, what I push on a lot in my podcast is people conflate, and this is something talked about in just general libertarian theory too, people conflate governance with statism, and they conflate authority with statism. And to me, like, that is the great lie, and one of the greatest successes of state propaganda is they've robbed these words and made them only to be associated with the state and with central planning. And that's just not true. You can have authority, you can have governance, you know, in the market. You can have rules, you can have law. Yeah. And so, like, you know, to me, true anarchists and true libertarians, we're not against order, we're not against law, not against governance. What we're against is the monopoly of those things that is created through the initiation of force via, you know, what we call the state, and something that violates law. Basically, like the best way I can summarize it is that the state isn't an agent of order. The state is actually an agent of chaos when you think about it, because it violates the very supposed natural law that it's justifying itself by.
Sure. So do you see why people could get an authoritarian message out of the Bible? Because I kind of took the same direction you did when I was a Christian, but I could see why people would become authoritarian Zionist statists also, especially because of how high the stakes are. You know, like if you see certain verses that seem to advocate for control or to allow violence in some situations, then you also see that, you know, the stakes are so high that all these people are going to hell and these false prophets are misleading them. Can you see why people would go that way, I guess?
I mean, I can kind of understand where they're coming from. But I think the problem is, I mean, we have centuries of the church where it was literally mixed with the state when they were like one and the same. So a lot of like traditions and teachings of Christianity are corrupted in that sense. So in the same sense that public schools now are like indoctrination camps, the church for a long time was used as an indoctrination camp. So a lot of Christianity has been warped in that sense. Then there's also certain passages that get misused. Like the most common one is Romans 13, It's like the biggest one. Like, it literally, any conversation about Christian anarchism, my running gag is like, you can't go 5 minutes without it coming up. And it's almost been proven true. Like, every podcast, this might be the first podcast I've been on where I think we've gone more than 5 minutes without it being brought up. Like, when I went on Josh Smith's show, like, it was like literally 5 minutes, Romans 13 came up in the comments. I know when Malice went on Michael Knowles' show, and the minute Christian anarchy came up, because Malice had a famous Christian anarchist, Tolstoy. He had his writings in the Anarchist Handbook. And so when they got on that subject, Knowles was like, yeah, but what about Romans 13? And it's just, for me, I get tired of it, because like, I feel like we have good answers for it and they just don't take the time to look at it. But like, even a passage of Romans 13, like on its face, like if you look it up, like I have it pulled up here because I was prepared for it. Like, they, you know, when you look up verses online, they always like have like names to the chapter and stuff. So like, it's all framed like it's supposed to be talking about the state. But again, like I said, the state is actually an agent of chaos that contradicts what it's claiming to do. And so like the proof text, for example, like people don't read like the whole chapter in the context of the book, and they don't do enough critical thinking. Like, Romans 13 is really easy to debunk, in my opinion, because Romans 13 starts out by saying that everyone be subject to the governing authorities, the word there being accousia. And accousia has a lot of different uses in the New Testament. And what I like to tell people is that the only times it's only used a handful of times to describe states or kings. And whenever it's described that way, they're described as demonic forces of Satan. So it's like, pick your poison. If the word accousia means state, then you're, you know, the most consistent way of reading Romans 13 would be saying that we must submit to demonic evil kingdoms of Satan. So, you know, make that leap if you dare. The more consistent verse of the use accusia in this context is actually, it's talking about heavenly authority or like moral authority. And so it says, everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except that which God has established. And then says in verse 3, for rulers hold no terror to those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So all this takes a little bit of critical thinking. Is the state only a terror to those who do evil? And is it something that people who are good and doing what is right have no reason to fear? It's pretty much the exact opposite. And this is why I get, again, the state is actually an agent of chaos when you take an actual critical examination of it. And even God says this, like, you brought this up already. Like, go back to 1 Samuel 8. God pretty much, like, you know, Judges is actually, the book of Judges precedes 1 and 2 Samuel. Yep. And Judges was basically a, like, covenant community, like anarchist society, basically like a Jewish, you know, biblical anarchist society. They were kind of led by the elders and stuff, but the tribes were very decentralized.
Or and an anarchist, you know, theocracy, if you can imagine that.
Yeah, and you know, things weren't perfect in the book of Judges. Some bad stuff happened. There was a civil war at the end, so, and you know, that's not surprising to me. I mean, I think you would agree with me, like, anarchists and libertarians, we're not saying, hey, we get rid of the state and utopia is ushered in. Like, no, bad shit still happens. The state just doesn't make it better. And that's basically the book of Judges into 1 Samuel is basically like that exact lesson spelled out. It's like, yeah, anarchy kind of sucks sometimes, but the state, central planning, kings, they suck worse. God literally warns them, like, here's the conduct of the king you're going to ask for. He's going to take half your shit. He's going to enslave your children to plow his harvest and to serve in the front lines of his wars. And he's going to take your women and daughters and stuff to be his. And you will cry out to be delivered from the king that you've asked for. And on that day, I will not deliver you. Which God actually does repeatedly. Like, the rest of the Old Testament is basically this repeated theme of Israel falling, like asking for, like getting a new king. The king leads them into idolatry. They get taken over by a foreign nation. Israel repents, but they don't truly repent. They repent, but then they're like back to the, no, we need a king. And literally the other thing in First Samuel that I like to point out too, is that at the beginning, when Samuel goes to God and he's like, hey, they're asking for a king. What do I do? And God's like, well, don't worry about it. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me just like they've done from the very day I brought them out of Egypt. And he's referencing the golden calf. So really, it's like, when you look at this, it doesn't, to me, it's just very self-evident that God's pretty much telling us that, like, when you ask for a king, when you ask for humans to be rulers and masters over other people, you are committing a form of idolatry. So as much as, like, to me, the state violates the other, like, it violates a lot of the Ten Commandments. It violates do not murder. It violates do not steal. I would say it also, it promotes coveting, you know, what your neighbor has and stuff like that. But the most primary commandment it breaks is the first two, which is to, you know, love God and to bow down to no idol. Mm-hmm. So
what about slavery? I mean, the Bible doesn't really seem to reject slavery. And the funny thing is, the thing about the Bible is, you know how the Constitution is, I feel like the Constitution's pretty well written and pretty clear, but people will try to say, oh no, this isn't constitutional. You know, the Constitution actually doesn't want you to have an AR-15 because of, you know, it seems like anyone can make any argument they want to with the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Bible is much more vague and much bigger than the Constitution. So it seems like people are able to make whatever argument they want to back up their logic. And so they can say, you know, they can find verses here and there, and then they can emphasize certain parts. But slavery, it seems to me the easiest way to condemn slavery would have it in the Ten Commandments and say, you shall not own another human, where it doesn't seem like it ever is that explicit. And then there are times when Jesus even says, like, slaves obey your masters. So what about slavery in the Bible? How do you, because in the beginning of this episode, you were saying that it's very biblical that you cannot own another person. Where do you find that? How do you rectify that?
Well, to me, it's about, and there's this idea in Christianity and in apologetics called progressive revelation. That, you know, God is very much aware of how corrupt and evil we are. And so the revelation and the pushing to a higher standard of righteousness, like, that increases throughout the Bible. Like, and we see this in the Sermon on the Mount, right? Jesus pushes the moral teachings of the Old Testament. He doesn't contradict them, but he says, this isn't enough. Like, this was the bare minimum standard I gave you when you were, like, you know, complete heathens coming out of Egypt, and you still failed to live up to that. But, you know, this is what I'm pushing you towards. And this is why, you know, a lot of the first anti-slavery movements were Christian, what's the term?
Abolitionists.
Yeah. I kept wanting to say agorists. Like, no, it's not agorists. It's the other A word. But yeah, the abolitionists, because again, it's the idea that we're taking the general moral principles that God gave us, and we're pressing them more, toward, like, universalizing them. And continuing that tradition. And, you know, the other classic apologist point here to make is that there's a little bit of a conflation in the Bible between, like, slavery and, like, indentured servitude. And and a lot of time there's a lot of mixture in terms of, like, what the scriptures are talking about there. Indentured servitude was a economic, like, universal, and even slavery was. And sometimes they kind of were muddy in terms of, like, what the difference between the two of them was. You know, even in the Old Testament and stuff, there were a lot of rules and restrictions about how you treated your servant. All debts were wiped clear every 7 years in the year of Jubilee. So there was that. And again, I think, you know, one of the most classic Bible stories is God setting his people free from slavery in Egypt. And in that case, God was very anti-slavery. So I think it's more about, like, God realizing, like, listen, I could lay out perfectly, here's everything you have to do to be perfect, but, like, he knew, okay, if I give this to the Israelites, they're not going to follow it. They failed to live up to the, like, you know, by our standards today, we look at the moral teachings of the Old Testament and we're like, yeah, this stuff's good. And this stuff's like, wow, that's barbaric. And we're like, yeah, it's barbaric, but you compare it to the surrounding cultures and it was actually highly evolved. And then Jesus pushes raises the bar in the New Testament. And then the Christian tradition, not perfectly, but continues to try to raise the bar. and to live in that continually trying to look at ourselves and to be like, okay, well, you know, let's look at the Ten Commandments. Let's look at the example of Jesus. And that's really where we have to, as Christians, we're Christians, right? So let's look at the walk of Jesus. And there's really not much other than like, yeah, Jesus said, treat your slaves, treat your masters well. That was kind of in the vein of like Roman, of like turn the other cheek, and kind of like the idea of like, don't overcome evil with evil, but overcome evil with good. So kind of like that kind of context is what Jesus is, because like it was, Jesus always talked about like, if you're put in a shitty situation, you can be bitter about it, you can rebel against it, but what might be better for you in the long run is actually to just take that on nobly. And the idea of like bear your cross nobly, like Jordan Peterson talks about that. Mm-hmm. Look at the example of Joseph in the book of Genesis. Like, he had probably like the worst set of circumstances happen. His brothers sell him into slavery. Sure. And then he's slave, but he's like, oh, I'm gonna excel at being a slave. And then he's like promoted up in the positions, he's trusted with a lot of things, and then he's betrayed, put back in jail, but he still has faith in God, and he still tries to be the best he can be in his circumstances. So, you know, that's like the, I don't want to go too long on this. It's a very complicated subject, and I'm not, there are Christian apologists that probably have better, more like expounded answers on the topic of slavery, but that's kind of like the general overview of what, you know, I think the Bible says on slavery, and why I think most Christians have naturally over time realized that, even though there's not like a specific passage that's just like, you know, thou shalt not take slaves, there's a historical and theological evolution at play here that Christians have come to understand.
Yeah, I mean, Joseph, in fact, he forgives his brothers instead of following the law of the Old Testament. So my question with that theory that, you know, we're supposed to continually push the envelope with morality, can that be a slippery slope? Because that does seem to be like what progressive Christianity is about, and universalism, things like that. So getting rid of the idea of hell, getting rid of the idea of homosexuality being a sin, it seems like that's kind of what they're doing. So is there a slippery slope there? How do you draw the line? Because I know you said that, you know, Jesus didn't contradict the Old Testament, but he kind of did. I mean, it was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and then turn the other cheek is the new. I mean, that's kind of a contradiction. It's kind of like,
so that's a common, I would say that's a common, like, I understand your perspective, and that's a common, and it's understandable to have that position, but mm-hmm. I actually don't think what Jesus said there was contradicting, because actually there are passages in the Old Testament where it talks about loving your enemies, and if your enemy does you harm and you return to them in kindness, it's like dumping coals on their head. And sure. So Jesus was actually echoing the Old Testament back to them. And basically the theme, like that passage came from the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount can be understood in like this general framing. And it's kind of like what I was referencing earlier with slavery. The Old Testament law was not a standard to do this and you have obtained the highest level of righteousness. Mm-hmm. It was like, here's the minimal standard of laws you need to follow to not be in my wrath. And it was like, it was almost like, this is as evil as I will allow you to be. But Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount is saying, listen, just because I give you a limit on how evil you can be, doesn't mean I want you to just ride that line and be like, ha, look, I'm being as evil as I can be. Look at me. Like, how, it's like, no, the goal shouldn't be to be as evil as you can be. The goal should be to be as righteous as you can be. And so what Jesus is doing is reminding them of a lot of stuff that's in the Old Testament that they cherry pick out, that they ignore. And so it's much easier to be like, well, you said eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And Jesus, like, well, that's a legal code in terms of like, if someone steals from you, they owe you back what they stole. But like, if someone steals a loaf of bread from you, you don't burn their house down. So that was sort of like the reason for that legal precedent, was to be like reciprocity in law. Like, if someone, you know, punches you, you can't go murder their wife. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's just, those are incongruent. Like, you know what I mean? You can't take revenge and go above and beyond. But Jesus is like, okay, well, just because eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth is the legal precedent in terms of like barring how far you can go as restitution, doesn't mean that that is all I've ever said on the subject of what happens when somebody steals from you.
So
if that makes sense.
Did Jesus give us the fullest extent of morality, or do you think it goes beyond what Jesus told us in the New Testament?
I think Jesus was the best representation of two things. One, like you know, I'm a Trinitarian, so I believe that I believe in the Trinity and that Jesus was God. So I think Jesus is the best picture of God's love and God's heart for humankind, for man. And I think that Jesus is in a general sense, yes, in terms of like he gives us the framework by which we like it is the highest level of morality in the sense of like it was God walking on earth. So like and he was giving us that framework. Obviously, we've had to take that and apply that in terms of like universally applying it to all areas of life. And I guess to put it this way, like Jesus gave us the highest level of morality, but Jesus didn't touch on every subject, I guess would be to say, you know what I mean? So like we have to take the moral principles that Jesus gave us, which was like a crystallizing and a refocusing of what he had always been saying, even throughout the Old Testament. And then saying like, all right, like, you know, again, like using the Sermon of the Mount as a sort of like focal point to be like, let's try to like, I wouldn't say like we should be trying to go beyond Jesus. And I think that's the problem that the progressives have is they're like, oh, well, like we can ascend past the morality that Jesus teaches. And I'm like, well, I don't think you can. I think you can just learn to apply it more consistently in your own personal life and to apply it to more areas in society, such as slavery or such as the treatment of women or minorities or what have you. And I don't think there's anything wrong with those things, but there's a point where you've gone too far and you're adding things in there that aren't actually part of like the focus on progressivism where they start like pushing the idea of like positive rights and stuff like that. Like that's where they've gone too far, for example, and they're using the state to provide welfare and all that. Like it's an example of going like Jesus, you did say like what you've done to the least of these you've done unto me, but he said what you've done, not what you licensed state thug, you know, thugs hired by the state to do on your behalf.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, my dad used to say everything in the Bible is true, but not everything that is true is in the Bible. Would you kind of say that's a good summary of what you were saying there? Like the idea that as long as you're not contradicting what's in the Bible, there are other truths and things that you can spread the message to areas that maybe Jesus didn't talk about, but you can kind of see how they would fit. Is that a good way to put it? Or?
Yeah, I think that's probably generally true. I'd have to chew on that a bit, but I think I'm not finding any problem with that. I think that's probably mostly accurate. Like not every, like everything in the Bible and everything that Jesus said specifically is to me true. But again, it's like, you can't talk about everything because then the Bible would literally like never end. Right. Like there's so many different circumstances, right? Like you couldn't write them all down in a book. So you can't literally write down a commandment or a passage that will touch every single conceivable circumstance in life or every single statement of truth that you could ever come up with. But it certainly gives you a sufficient framework and foundation to build upon and to universalize out.
Yeah, I get you. So going back to the idea of Jesus being an anarchist, which is what I thought when Christianity was the realest ever that it was to me, I didn't really think he was a libertarian. So I thought that he didn't believe in government force. He didn't believe in coercion. But there were a couple things that didn't seem very libertarian about the way he was. So one thing to me, libertarianism, a core tenet, is it matters what you do, not what you think. Like if you, you know, we don't punish people for thought crimes in libertarianism at all. But the Bible is one of the most thought crime punishing books out there, especially in the New Testament, because Jesus is actually, the Old Testament is actually a little bit more tolerant of thought crimes. But in the New Testament, Jesus says, I don't care if you haven't committed adultery. If you look at a woman with lust, you have already done it in your heart.
Yep.
You've looked at, if you've looked at your brother with hatred, then you've killed him in your heart.
Yep.
That didn't seem very libertarian to me. The idea that, you know, just because your thoughts bring you somewhere or your emotions bring you somewhere, but you don't actually do the dirty deed, you are still just as guilty. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess my answer to that would be that, you know, libertarianism is a thin philosophy that describes like rights and like a legal framework and the non-aggression principle. And, you know, we all here understand that. Christianity is compatible with libertarianism, but, you know, it is a deeper moral philosophy. So, right. You know, libertarianism is what is required to be sufficiently operating in like cooperation with those around you. But the Bible goes beyond that to talk about, I guess, like morality in the Christian sense and sort of like your relationship to God, and what it takes to be a good person. And I think we all kind of know this intuitively. Like, you can be someone who is perfectly in keeping with libertarian principles of rights, but people would still say that like you're immoral or you're dishonorable, or you're not somebody that people want to be around, not someone of high integrity. So to me, that would be the distinction. I think that would answer your question.
Yeah. I should have asked you, do you think Jesus is a libertarian? Or
see, I don't even know. Like, it's a little bit of a complicated question. I don't even know if I would say Jesus is an anarchist, even though like I kind of agree with both of those statements, but I also feel like it's kind of like humanizing Jesus on a level too much that I'm not comfortable with, I guess, is like why I'm a little resistant to use those terms. You know, like, so I don't know. I think Jesus, what he taught is compatible with libertarianism. I don't think I need to call him a libertarian or even call him an anarchist. He was certainly, you know, modeling in the sense that like, cause he was fully, it's really, this gets into like Trinitarianism and it's very complicated because like Jesus was fully man and fully God. So the part of Jesus that was fully man, I guess, was a libertarian and an anarchist, but the part of him that was fully God, it would be, I think, kind of like a categorical error to label God a libertarian or an anarchist, because those are kind of human labels.
Let's just talk the man, Jesus.
The man, then yeah, I would say like if we're talking about Jesus, the man, yeah, definitely a libertarian and definitely an anarchist.
Yeah, I would say I agree with you that he was compatible with libertarianism. You know, the way that Jesus lived himself and the way that he wanted people to live, I think is compatible with libertarianism, because even with the thought crimes thing, I mean,
they weren't really crimes, right? Like he wasn't saying, and the minute you lust after another woman, you should be locked in jail. Like, right. Like he wasn't saying you violated anyone's rights. He's just saying,
right.
You know, and I think like, you know, like let's take the spiritualness out of this. Let's just talk about like, is there merit to what Jesus is saying? I think there is. Like if you're in a marriage, but you're going around like, you know, watching porn all the time, or even not watching porn, just like fantasizing about being with other women and stuff, you might not be honoring your wife very well. You know what I mean? Like, even if you're not technically cheating on her in your, like in the actions that you're doing in your heart, that you kind of are not being loyal to her to the extent that you probably should. So I think there's merit to what Jesus is saying. I don't think he's, you know, and at no point does he conflate those things with like, you know, like you've murdered someone, like you should, or even when he says you hate your brother, you've committed murder in your heart. He is clearly specifying like you've done it in your heart. But there's a difference between doing something in your heart where it's like you are in a state of moral conflict in your mind and your soul that you need to resolve versus you've committed a crime. Like there's a difference between those two things. So I don't think he's really.
That's actually where I was going with that. That's why I was saying, I think even the thought crime idea is compatible with libertarianism, because he wasn't suggesting that you should be locked up for looking at a woman with lust. You know, so like, just like I think racism can be compatible with libertarianism. I don't think it's, I don't agree with it, but
yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, it's like you can be a racist piece of shit and still be consistent in your like adherence to libertarian principles. That's why I think, you know, libertarianism is a thin philosophy. I don't think it is necessary but not sufficient to be a good person, right? Like you can be a libertarian and not a good person, but I think to be as good of a person as you could be, you should be a libertarian.
Yeah. So here's an interesting little thought experiment here, but I think you can not believe in property rights and still not violate libertarianism. So I don't think you should be a libertarian thinker. But if you're someone who thinks the idea of private property is stupid, but you personally are not going to infringe on other people's private property, then your existence is not going to violate the ideas of libertarianism, if that makes sense.
So,
when it comes to self-defense, I kind of think that about with Christianity. Like, I think Christianity is compatible with libertarianism, but I don't think that Christianity teaches self-defense. So I don't think that it would violate the idea of libertarianism, but I think Jesus would not tell you to kill someone to protect yourself. And I realize that there are some verses you can cherry pick and, you know, certain passages you can find that seem to justify it. But from most of what Jesus taught, self-defense does not seem very high on his list. I mean, he said, like, don't fear the one who can kill your body, feel the one who can destroy your soul in hell. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. You know, there's just like nothing about
called sinful by Jesus or the Bible, but I do get what you're pressing on as far as like, is it something that he would advocate for as preferable or the correct way to live? And you know, it's a complicated thing. Some of those passages, as far as like, so what's to talk about, like the most famous one is those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And I think this one's really misused by pacifists and taken out of context. And listen, I'm very close to pacifism, and I think, to be honest, you would even say libertarians are pretty, compared to the rest of the world, libertarians look almost like pacifists at times, right? Because like it is so foreign to statists to be against the initiation of force that anyone who's anti-war and who's pro-NAP is almost like, oh, you're just basically a pacifist, and you'll be like, well, I'm okay with self-defense. To get back to what I was saying, The passage live by the sword, die by the sword is taken out of context, in my opinion. Because, well, let's keep in mind the context of that line is it's Jesus in the garden, and the Pharisees have come to take him. Judas has betrayed him, and Peter goes after them with a sword and cuts the ear of the high priest off, I think. Sure. And Jesus stops him and says, no, stop. And what he says before the line of those who live by the sword, die by the sword, he reminds, I forget the exact wording, but he basically reminds Peter, like, will I not take the cup that my father has prepared for me? And reminds him, like, did I not tell you this was going to happen? Like, Jesus prophesied this exact moment multiple times. He'd been telling them for weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to be turned in. I'm going to be killed. And I'm going to come back in 3 days. The problem was, like, the problem was Peter and the apostles were not living by faith. They were living by their own understanding and like by what they could control. And I think in this context, what Jesus is condemning is not Peter for acting in self-defense, but for Peter not acting in faith, for acting in doubt. And this also, I think, is further supported by like the whole story of like Peter denying Jesus 3 times before the rooster crowed and all that. Like the thing with Peter was his like he was brilliant at times in his discernment in terms of like he was the first one to proclaim Christ as savior. And then that's that famous passage where he's like, you are the rock upon which I will build my church. But he also is one who famously struggles with his faith. And so I think that is what that verse in context is talking about. That's my opinion, at least. The other ones about like turning your other cheek and stuff. I mean, again, Jesus says, turn your other cheek, not like roll over and die. I think the context of that passage is like the imagery he uses there and then the examples he gives are not life-threatening scenarios. If someone slaps you, your life's not in danger, really. He also says, like, if someone asks you to walk 1 mile with them, walk 2 miles. Yeah. You know, and other things like that.
Mentioned, though, is and this was what like really struck me about him in general, with the idea of, don't fear the one who can destroy your body, fear the one who can destroy your soul in hell. That was the essence of his being as a man on planet Earth, you know, was like,
oh yeah, I think that's
the Roman government, don't worry about the Romans, I know they can kill you, who cares, like, worry about your heart, worry about the condition of your soul. So he like, especially with that verse, and then the testimony of his life, it seems very, maybe it's not a condemnation of self-defense, but certainly not an encouragement of it.
I think what Jesus is doing, and it's like, I don't think what you're saying is quite right, but it's also like, it's kind of in the middle. I think what Jesus is saying is not that self-defense is bad, but also reminding us to have faith and to not, again, like just like with Peter, like, don't live by faith in just yourself and your abilities alone. Because if you focus only on that, you are, in a sense, failing to have faith in God. And so there's it's a tension, right? Between what do we trust God for and what do we take care of ourselves? And this kind of reminds me of like that, you ever heard like that, like a little story? It's not like a real story. It's like the one where like a man believes that God's going to rescue him from a hurricane or a flood, and ends up dying after like a boat and a helicopter came and tried to save him. And he said, no, God's going to save me. And then he goes up to heaven and he's like, God, why didn't you save me? And God says, well, I sent a boat and a helicopter for you, dumbass. Why didn't you get on them? So there's this dichotomy between like, you know, trusting God and then kind of like dealing with the real world. And that's a tension that a Christian has to walk on, walk through. And there's no clear answers other than just to, you know, not get too, I think it's like a balance, because like we're also said to be in the world, but not of it. And I think that's the dichotomy we have to wrestle with, which is like finding that balance between like not being lazy and just kind of like expecting, oh God, you'll do it for me, but also not being so self-dependent that we don't rely on God for anything and almost like act like we can live our life without God. So I think that's the tension of those passages that Jesus is pushing on, is not so much a condemnation of self-defense, but more a reminder to not be too focused and obsessed on only what you can do and not giving God credit to be able to provide.
Gotcha. Well, we're coming up on an hour here, so we'll cut it off. But thanks for coming on, man. I'm noticing a lot of tension between between Christians and atheists in the liberty movement, and I think it's really dumb. And I think that people don't understand that, you know, there are certain arguments that are going to resonate with different people better. So people who are religious, if you can make a religious argument for libertarianism, then that's good, because you're going to be able to convince them that libertarianism is the way. And then people who are not religious, if you can convince them of liberty in a non-religious way, that's also a good thing. And we have to be doing both of those things at the same time. And obviously those ideas can maintain congruence with libertarianism, but they're obviously going to conflate with, you know, what you're preaching, what I'm preaching about religion. And that's okay. Like the idea that I could try to make a comparison between the ridiculousness of the church and the rituals that the church does and the crazy things they'll have you believe, and then, you know, liken that to the state. And then you can point to like, the values of believing in something higher than humanity and how the state is just us and it's a crock of shit and it's just centralized planning and it's bogus.
Sure.
We should be able to do both of those things and not hate each other. And I think you and I are good examples of that, but a lot of people need to learn from that and, you know, need to internalize that a little bit. I was wondering, just to close out, have you seen that and what do you think about it?
Yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. I think the problem, I'm trying to remember my train of thought, I just lost it. I think the problem is that some people have baggage, for one. I think like there's Christians that have baggage with atheists because like some atheists have attacked them and they might have felt, you know, personally judged. Atheists that have baggage with the church, I'm really sympathetic to atheists who have baggage with the church. And honestly, when you said, when you made your thing, like, I'll make a comparison between the traditions of the church that seem silly and the state, it's like, well, I do that too, actually. So we're not even really in conflict there. A lot of what, you know, it's like, I always tell atheists, it's like, we have a lot in common, because, like, I feel like sometimes I hate Christians in the church more than atheists do sometimes, because a lot of what is bad about Christianity to me is a result of that mixture between the church and the state. And I'd encourage, you know, people, if you haven't, to go study the early church, because it was actually a lot different in the way it was formulated and run, you know, pre-Constantine, before that mixture happened. But yeah, I think in general, we need to focus more on fighting the state than fighting each other. And, you know, you're not going to, I, you know, I mean, it's like, I'm not going to waste time trying to convince you to be a Christian, because, like, you know, I don't think that's my job in this context. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to talk to me in private and we want to have more detailed discussions about your faith or lack thereof, like, that's fine. But, like, otherwise, it's like, it's your business what you believe, and it's your life. And you probably feel that same way about me. And I don't know, I think it's better to approach these subjects with kind of like a humility and intellectual curiosity, to be like, if we're going to discuss these things, let's do it from a place of good faith. And like, hey, here's where we agree and here's where we diverge, and try to learn from each other, and then get back to like fighting the things that actually matter more. Because at the end of the day, I don't care about your atheism and you don't care about my Christianity if we both agree on not using the state to push either of our beliefs on one another. And I think that's the most important thing. And if Christians and atheists and other people of different faiths, if we can't unite under that, then we're screwed. You know what I mean? So we have to, you know, hate the state more than we disagree with one another. And I feel like that should be more common sense than, you know, an easy conclusion to come to. And it's unfortunate that there's some that haven't come to it yet.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks for coming on. I'll definitely have you back on in the future. Hopefully God stops trying to interrupt our, you know, video meetings that we're trying to do. But I've got your YouTube linked in the description, along with your Twitter page. Anything else you want to plug? Any final thoughts? Anything you want to add before we end the video?
I don't know if there's anything else I want to plug too much. I do have a website that's going to be released soon. It's there right now, but if you go there, it's like half up, half still in template mode. But it'll be done, I think, by the end of next week. It's just daniel318.com. So you can go there, and I'll be starting a blog and stuff there. So if you guys want to check that out, you can do that. And, you know, other than that, my closing thought, you know, I saw a comment here where someone said we can defend ourselves better without violence most of the time. And, you know, one thing I think that's interesting is that there's a lot of relation between Austrian economics and Christianity too, which might be something that we want to talk about on a future episode. Cause I don't know if you follow, like if you've read Bob Murphy at all, but like a lot of the things he talks about, he's a Christian who is kind of a pacifist, but he talks about a lot about how, like, you know, the market, and this is like what Mises talked about too, right? Like the market promotes social cooperation and peace. And that's what we're all about, right? Like, you know, as a Christian, I want peace with my fellow man, and I want to love my neighbor, and that's what it's about for me. And I think that, yeah, to close out that, you know, even if you're not a Christian, you know what I mean? For one, my podcast isn't just talking about scripture all the time, but two, even the times where I am, you can just view the Bible as a collection of stories, in my opinion. That's fine. I think stories, even just by themselves, can still be impactful and insightful, and they can teach about valuable archetypes and valuable insights about the human condition and history. And, you know, and so I don't need you to be religious or believe in God for us to have a good conversation, for us to work well together. At the end of the day, you know, I try to make sure that I'm working well together with everyone in good faith, and that, you know, we don't pick fights that don't need to be picked. So other than that, thanks for having me on, man. It was a really fun conversation.
Yeah, anytime. Go follow him on YouTube. Go follow him on Twitter. Tomorrow night, I will be streaming with Dak Rouleau. So check in for that. And I will see you guys on the next stream.